binding the saints. Make sure that now, binding the saints. Brother West, Lord bless your service with this hour.
Thank you, Brother Jim. And good afternoon, brethren. It's our privilege and our pleasure for Sister Tony and I to be with you, and for those who were not with us yesterday, we bring you the loving greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31, has been selected by the brethren as the theme text of this convention. And you have before you on the easel this text, which you've had the privilege, and I have had the privilege, of looking at for approximately a day and a half at this point. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. We first would like to spend some time ripping off the crust of this text. The crust is the English language. And until we scrape off that layer of crust, we cannot enjoy the beauty of the nut that is contained within. We need and we want to focus on several of the Hebrew terms in here because they are rich with meaning. Let's look first at the word wait. Now, when you think of the word wait, what comes to mind? Delay, idleness. I'm going to wait for the bus. Well, what are you doing while you wait for the bus? Well, a lot of people don't do anything. They just wait. They just stand in idleness. Friends, that could not be any further from the concept of the subject we'll be considering today. The word wait, and of course it's actually wait upon. The word wait upon, or that phrase, comes from a word that means to bind together by twisting. To bind together by twisting. We're going to use the word intertwine. They that intertwine themselves with the Lord. My father was an auto mechanic for about 25 years. He was self-employed. And this was 1940s, 1950s, and about first half of 1960s. And in addition to being an auto mechanic, he also sold gasoline. And he also ran a towing service. He had a tow truck. And I can remember as a youngster, he was part of a network that would get phone calls, and we'd get phone calls all hours of the night. Somebody had an accident, somebody went down over the hill, whatnot, needed to be towed. The vehicle needed to be towed. So we'd jump in the tow truck, and off we go to render assistance. And oftentimes, I saw my father line up the tow truck. He anchored the front of that truck to a guardrail or to a tree, and there'd be some kind of vehicle down over the bank. And he'd string out this piece of steel cable that was connected to a winch, which is a power mechanism to draw the cable in. And he'd pull that, he'd attach that cable to that vehicle and bring it up out of the ditch or whatever it was in. Friends, that piece of cable that was used to pull tons of weight was no larger in diameter than my index finger. It was steel cable. You know what steel cable is made out of? It's small strands of wire that are bound together by twisting. They are intertwined. And that's what gives it its strength. You know, I've tried to use a piece of electrical wire, maybe 18-gauge electrical wire, which just has single strands, unbound, to tie something together. Doesn't seem like it has any strength at all. But the strength that was produced by that steel cable, that many little steel strands tied together, bound together by twisting, the concept of strength. How about they shall renew their strength? Well, the word renew here has two thoughts. First, the first thought that we can gain from the word renew is to regain. Now, if we regain something, It generally suggests that it's something that we had before and perhaps we've lost it to some extent. So if you regain something, you actually are getting back something that you perhaps had in the past and lost it. Perhaps we've had, I know Sister Tony and I have a plant at home. It's a Scheffalera, and we have it out on our patio in the back. It's a southern exposure. And that plant lets you know when it needs water. It's a Scheffalera, and it really starts to droop when it's looking for water. Boy, you pour water on it, and boy, within a very short period of time, that plant's perked back up again. It's regained its strength. But there's an additional thought here with this idea of renewing their strength. The New American Standard says, we'll gain new strength. And the idea here seems to be not only just getting something back that perhaps we've lost, but actually increasing it. Maybe going a level above what we had before. So it can be the idea of regaining or the idea of actually increasing our strength. The word strength, renew their strength, comes from a word that means vigor or capacity. So we're looking here at the concept of vigor. So if we look at what we've got so far, we say they that intertwine or bind themselves with the Lord, these are the ones that will regain and increase their spiritual vigor. At this point, we, at the risk of being reprimanded later, I want to thank, I think credit should be given where credit is due, and I want to thank my earthly beloved for going to the library and checking out about 6 books on birds. And she was kind enough to go through and do a lot of preliminary scanning for me, and she talked about 15 or 20 little markers in all these books, and she says, you might want to read this. And we hope to share some of these thoughts with you this afternoon. They shall mount up. So the next phrase we want to look at is mount up. Mount up means to ascend or to be high. Now, we appreciate the NIV translation here because the NIV uses the word soar. They shall soar. And that when we think of the word soar, in fact, Webster defines it as meaning to sail in the air at a great height. To sail in the air at a great height. But you know, there's another concept here we found in our bird research about the use of the word soar. Soar not only has the thought of sailing at a great height, but it also contains the thought of staying up for long periods of time by using the updrafts of the air currents. We're going to come back to that point in a little bit. You know, we think of, in this day and age, with gas furnaces, or no comparison as far as how much energy they use compared to what gas furnaces 20 or 30 years ago used. Automobiles are much more fuel efficient. And we think that energy conservation is something new. But believe it or not, the eagles that we're going to be talking about today, they are the masters of energy conservation. They stay up without any wing movement by taking advantage of these air currents. Let's look at the word with wings. They shall soar with wings. Now, the word wings here is from the Hebrew word eber, E-B-E-R, and it means pinion. Now, perhaps some of us who are somewhat mechanically inclined have heard of rack and pinion steering on your automobile. Well, that was a new concept a few years back. And I remember my father teaching me about rack and pinion steering, or a ring gear and pinion when you used to have a differential in the back of the car. Then something small, like a small gear going into a bigger gear, seems to be the thought of a pinion. But here we're not talking about gears. We're talking about a bird's wing. Now, a pinion, by definition, according to Webster, is the terminal section of the bird's wing. Now, picture a bird's wing as your arm. And the pinion would be pretty much from the wrist out to the end of the wing. An pinion contains the primary, what's considered the primary flight feathers of the bird. These are the most important feathers for the bird to get off the ground and to fly. The feathers that are contained where your and my forearm would be are considered the secondary flight feathers. If you clip some of the secondary flight feathers, the bird can still fly. But if you clip the pinion feathers, that bird cannot fly. And Sister Tony and I have some friends who have a cockatiel in their home, and they have just one of the wings of that bird clipped so that it can't fly around the house. But they clipped a pinion feather from that bird. But the eber focuses, eber, the word wings here, the Hebrew word eger, focuses on the wing from the strength point of view. We say, well, how else can we focus on a bird's wing? Well, by contrast, let's take a look at a text in Psalms that we're all familiar with, Psalms chapter 91, verse 4. Psalms chapter 91, verse 4. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings thou shalt trust. His truth shall be thy shield and thy buckler. The word wings here is not eber. The word wings here is a Hebrew word, kanaph, K-A-N-A-P-H. And here, this text uses an entirely different Hebrew word to convey a different concept. Here, we're not looking at the wing from the strength point of view, but from what? From a protection point of view. So we're not looking so much here at the pinion feathers as we are the secondary, where the bird has much of its feathers to protect its young in the event of a threat of danger, and so on. They shall soar with the pinions. They shall soar by using their pinions just like eagles. Now let's take a look at the word eagle. The word eagle comes from the Hebrew word nesher. And we're going to be using that word a good bit. It's spelled N-E-S-H-E-R, nesher. The word nesher comes from a root word to mean lacerate. When we think of lacerating flesh, we know it means to cut flesh. And it goes on to define the word nesher as an eagle or other large bird of prey. Now, what are birds of prey? Well, a bird of prey is something like a hawk. A bird of prey can be a bald eagle, any kind of an eagle, golden eagle, bald eagle. An owl is considered a bird of prey, a falcon, or an osprey. In Palestine, there are 40 different kinds of neshers. But most likely, whenever we see the word nesher in the scriptures, most likely it refers to one of two kinds of birds, either a griffon vulture or a golden eagle. And it's the same golden eagle as what we have in this country. I don't know whether we have any griffon vultures. I don't think we have any griffon vultures in this country. But a nesher can either be a griffon vulture or a golden eagle. They are both, the griffon vulture is more plentiful in Palestine than the golden eagle. But both are there. And they were the most common ones over there that probably, according to what we found out, would be the ones that be referred to. Let's consider now some of the characteristics of this nesher that we're talking about. Let's take a look at Job. Job chapter 9, verse 26. Job 9, 26. They are passed away as the swift ships, as the eagles that hasteth to the prey. The word we want to focus on for the moment is the word prey, P-R-E-Y. The eagle, we know, is a hunter, because a bird of prey is a bird that has to hunt for its food, and it actually feeds itself by eating meat. It's a meat-eating bird. Webster says that a bird of prey is a bird that feeds on meat by hunting or lacerating. The point here, I think, that we can draw from the nesher is that the nesher has to work hard for its food. This nesher ordinarily will spend hours soaring high, looking for food. Friends, it's just not something that's handed to them. They've got to look for it. They've got to work for it. And once they find that, they have to exercise the skill to swoop down on that prey and to be able to capture that prey. Particularly if you're talking about an eagle, now if you're talking about a vulture ordinarily eats carrion. We are told that a golden eagle will also eat carrion. Carrion is like roadkill. Carrion is stuff that's already dead. But ordinarily, the vulture will only eat carrion, whereas the golden eagle will either eat carrion or it will kill things that are still living. But in any event, the nesher has to use sharp claws, hook beak, and so on. It was about a month ago, and you know, you never know where the Lord helps you to kind of prepare for these lessons, but in our area, we have red-tailed hawks. Now, a hawk, of course, is a bird of prey. There was what we think was a hawk up in our backyard, and I don't want to get too graphic here, but this hawk was working pretty hard for its food. It already captured its prey, and what it was doing, it was lacerating the prey, and it was eating it up in the backyard. But the point is, that hawk had to work for its food. Now, by contrast, we like to feed the birds in our backyard, and we'll feed seed-eating birds. Well, they just kind of went in, and there's not too much work for those birds to eat. And the hummingbirds, it's even easier. And we kind of feed them. They go in and they take the food. They don't have to. There's no skill involved. There's no speed involved. They don't have to have sharp claws or anything. So you really are talking about quite a different kind of a bird. But the nesher has to work hard for its food. And friends, we think that there's a very apropos spiritual lesson for you and I, that we also need to work hard for our food. Now, how do we work hard for our food? Keep in mind now, the word nesher means to lacerate. How can you and I lacerate the scriptures, so to speak? Well, I think there are several ways that we do that. We tear them apart sometimes, don't we? Maybe it's something like we're doing right now. You'll actually consult a lexicon, and you'll dig, you'll just rip into it, you'll dig down into it, and find the deeper meaning to a particular text. Attending class, attending conventions, private fellowship, discussion time, probing one another's minds. This is the way that we lacerate our food that we are given. But the point is, just like the nesher has to lacerate its food and tear it into pieces in order to eat it, that's what you and I do. And remember the way that the volumes are characterized or described to us? It's the Bible broken into edible portions. So a lot of this lacerating work is already done for us. And friends, we don't want to get the idea here that we have to go look for our own source of food. And in this particular context, it might be better on this particular point to think more of the griffin vulture than the golden eagle. Matthew 24:45. We are told, Matthew 24:45. Who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give him meat in due season? Friends, we believe that the appropriate approach is for us to eat, to lacerate what the Lord has given us. Not going out and searching for new food in other areas. Eat what the Lord has given us. That's what the griffin vulture does. It eats what has essentially been provided to it. Remember up in, in fact, it's the earlier part of this same chapter. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Now the word, of course, here is not nesher because it's Greek and not Hebrew. But we believe, in fact, there's a number of translations that translate the word eagles there as vultures. And so we think that on this particular point, it probably would be a little more helpful to think of a vulture than an eagle. Okay, so the nesher has to work hard for its food. Let's consider another attribute of the nesher. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 19. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 19. The way of an eagle in the air. I'm going to back up to verse 18, actually. Proverbs chapter 30, verses 18 and 19. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not. The way of a nesher in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. And of course, we're interested in the first part of verse 19, the way of the nesher in the air. By the way, all these texts that we're looking at, where you see eagle, they're all nesher. What is the way of the nesher in the air? Well, if we think here of the nesher in the sense of the golden eagle, at least, and probably this applies to the vulture as well, the eagle in particular is legendary for what? It's eyesight. Keen eyesight, being very far-sighted. In our research, we discovered that an eagle has the ability to spot a rabbit 1 to 2 miles away. That's far-sighted. That's very far-sighted. And we think there's a very apropos spiritual lesson for us, taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 20. Chapter 2, verse 10. 1 Corinthians 2:10. But God hath revealed them unto us by His Spirit, for the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. From way up on high, when this eagle, when this nesher is soaring, it looks way down deep to find its food. And isn't that what you and I are counseled to do? To look down deep for our food, just like the nesher. But you know, there's another aspect here of the nesher that I was not aware of before at all. We all have heard of the phrase eagle eyes, old eagle eyes, you know, somebody has good eyesight. But what I was not aware of was a term that I'm just going to call it panavision. And the eagle, and you and I have a tough time probably relating to this because we don't have the ability to do it. When you and I focus on... Let's say that you focus right now on my index finger. Now, what is in focus for your eyes? It's my index finger. Can you focus on what's on this easel without looking over there or here? No, you can probably have some sense that there's something there, but you really can't keep it all into focus. An eagle has the ability to actually take 180 degrees, and everything within that 180 degrees stays in focus. Even when this bird is flying at full speed, even in a dive for its food, everything within that 180 degrees is maintained in focus. And you know, I think there's a wonderful spiritual lesson here for us. You know, I think we at times can become specialists in our studies. Maybe we'd like to only study this or study that. But I believe that if we follow the characteristic of the nesher, we will try to study all of the divine plan. Oh no, we can't do it overnight. But we try to put all of the divine plan into focus, not just one point, not become specialists in that. You know, the world, the way of the world, of course, is the way of specialization. If you don't specialize this day in whatever you do, probably you're going to be left behind. I remember my grandfather... because I knew him, I can relate to this, and I'm sure many of us can relate to our forefathers of not too many generations back. My grandfather was an accomplished wheelwright. If you needed to make a wagon wheel, he could make a wagon wheel. He was a farmer, very accomplished farmer. He was an auto mechanic, very accomplished. He had the ability to do all this. But today, of course, this has sort of gone by the boards, hasn't it? And now this is the age of specialization. But friends, let's not go the way of the world in our studies of the scriptures. Let's try to put all the divine plan into our focus. There's one other point that we want to... This idea of the way of the nesher in the air, of course, is very general. So we can bring a lot of different nesher characteristics into this particular text as we find them. But you know, as we mentioned a little bit ago about the nesher's ability to conserve energy, to stay up for hours. I know I was coming home the other day, and I think it was a hawk that I saw. I was driving down the road, and here's this hawk way up in the air. And I just watched him for the longest time. Never moved. It didn't seem like he ever moved a feather. He was just catching the air currents, and it was about to be a storm. There was a storm brewing, and of course he was having a great time because there was actually more updraft probably than normal. And perhaps there's even a spiritual lesson here that we can draw from in connection with catching these updrafts. You know, at times we are offered help, aren't we? Brethren offer us help. We're offered help in many different ways, perhaps prayer help, maybe help with physical things that we no longer have the ability to do, or perhaps the time or whatever. But brethren are very known to reach out and to offer help to others. And just like the nesher doesn't try to do it all on its own. It takes advantage of the help that it's given it, the air. It doesn't try to stay up and flap its wings and do everything on its own, but it takes advantage of those upper air currents. And perhaps we can learn a lesson from this as well by accepting the help that's offered to us from our brethren of whatever kind. You know, when I was a youngster, and perhaps some of you may remember, the most unusual things sometimes stick in your mind. But I remember a commercial. I think it was a commercial for a painkiller on television. And there was this, the story was around a mother and a daughter. And the daughter apparently had a headache, and it was really bad. And her mother, I think they were in the kitchen. And the mother comes into the kitchen, and she is endeavoring to help her daughter. And the daughter says, "Mother, please, I'd rather do it myself." And sometimes I know this speaker has had a problem with that. And perhaps we too. Maybe on either end. Either we proffer help and it's rejected, or perhaps we are the ones that need the help, and we are the ones rejecting the help. Friends, let's try not to have the "mother please, I'd rather do it myself" syndrome. Because the nesher doesn't have that. The nesher takes advantage of the help, of the uplift that's given to it from others, from other sources, from the air. One other aspect of the way of the nesher that we can draw on from this scripture is that the nesher, whether it's a vulture or an eagle, is diurnal. That was a new term to me. It's spelled D-I-U-R-N-A-L. But all neshers are diurnal. Not all neshers, but the griffon vulture and the golden eagle, the principal ones that we are focusing on, are diurnal. Now, what's diurnal? Well, it's the opposite of nocturnal. We know what nocturnal means. Hamsters are nocturnal, and so on. But one of the birds that is a bird of prey that is nocturnal, which means it works at night rather than during the daylight, is an owl. In fact, it was just within a couple of days after the Salem Convention this past June, Sister Tony and I decided to kind of strike out for sort of parts unknown in central Oregon. So we went down to Bend, which is where they've been having the fires the last few days. And the brethren recommended that if we were going down to that area, to please look stop in at the High Desert Museum. And friends, we got a blessing and a half. And again, you never know where the Lord is going to kind of bring into contact with some experiences that kind of work into a lesson here or there. But that was the first time, even though I've worked on a farm, that was really the first time I came up really close to an owl. And what they did is, of course, we were there in the daytime, and ordinarily owls are sleeping during the day. So what they did is they tricked the owls, and they had them in this area where they had some kind of a real dim light But the owl stayed awake, and apparently they would turn the bright lights on at night, or at night, so that the owls would be awake during the night and asleep during the day, so we could always see them, because, you know, people don't go at night, they go during the day. So anyway, the owl, it was very interesting that the owl is a night worker. And you could see that owl, and it had bats also in this area where they had the owl. And the owl would go after the bat, and of course that was its prey. And we think that this idea of the nesher being diurnal, that it works during the daylight and not at night, again provides us with another beautiful lesson for the new creature. Let's take a look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 4 and 5. But ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief. Ye are all the children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night, nor of darkness. Friends, we should not be looking for our food in the darkness. We should be looking for our food in the light. Now, once again, the light that's been provided to you and I through the volumes, through the reprints, through the various components of the harvest message. That's where we look for our food, in the light. In our organization, we have, every once in a while, we have to go through interviews to hire people at different positions. And one of the people in our organization has a favorite question he likes to ask someone who's being interviewed for a job. And you know what he likes to ask them? Are you an owl or a fowl? The owl, being nocturnal, you know, kind of stays up most of the night, maybe kind of comes wandering in late in the morning and so on. The fowl, of course, is up early, works during the day, and generally goes to bed early. So this particular person, right or wrong, but he has his personal philosophy happens to be that there's probably an advantage if you're a fowl type person rather than an owl type person, working during the daylight. There are other attributes of the nesher, and certainly one that we don't want to overlook is brought to our attention in Exodus, the 19th chapter. Exodus chapter 19, verse 4. Exodus 19:4. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. The word bear here means to lift. I lifted you on nesher's wings. And so here again, we believe that the focus of this particular text, of all of the attributes that the nesher has, we believe that this is the key attribute that fits in our lesson in Isaiah 40:31, because it really concentrates on the idea of the strength. You know, our research indicated on the nesher that if you're looking at an eagle can carry between 3/4 and 1.5 times its body weight. 3/4 to 1.5 times. And fly with it. Now imagine you and I trying to pick up something that's 3/4 of our own body weight, or 1.5 times our body weight, and not just carrying it, but flying with it. Friends, we're talking about a very strong bird with the nesher. And we think that the eagle has certainly come to symbolize strength. You know, what's the national symbol of our country? Of course, is the bald eagle. When you look at next time you see a United States flag, you look on top of the flagpole, oftentimes you'll see an eagle sitting there. And of course, that's a bald eagle, which is different than a golden eagle, but it's still an eagle. Well, we believe that the principal reference here to the nesher in our text is really that of strength. But what kind of strength are we talking about here? It's certainly not physical strength. It's certainly not brain power. Friends, some of the most capable and learned brethren in the truth that I know didn't even finish the sixth grade. So it's not necessarily, you know, worldly brain power or brain power about the things of this earth. So what kind of strength are we talking about? We believe that Apostle Paul gives us the answer in Ephesians, the 6th chapter, verse 10. Ephesians 6:10, where Paul says, "Finally, brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might." Friends, we believe that the strength that our text is dealing with is a strength of faith. A strength of faith. A strength that is built upon what Paul says is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Trusting our Heavenly Father. The last part of the text here says, "And they shall run and not be weary." And if we look up the definition of those words, they shall rush and not become exhausted. Well, now, what is it that we are running for? Why are we running? Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Hebrews 12:1 says, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." We also have the text about even a little bit more specifically, which we won't take the time to read, but it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, that talks about running for the prize. Running for the prize of the high calling. But friends, have you ever asked yourself the question, why are we running the race? Why are we running for the prize of the high calling? It's not like we're trying to beat somebody else out of something. So why are we running? I don't know how many of you saw any of the Olympics, but I was particularly, not that I spent a lot of time on it, but I did see a little bit of the track and field events, particularly the track, because it brought back memories. I was on a track team back in high school, and so I'm always kind of interested, you know, when it comes to the Olympics, to see these top-notch athletes. And of course, this year's, you know, one of this year's American stars, I remember, was Michael Johnson. And not that I was, you know, really following him every second of the day. But did anybody happen to notice that after he ran his race, or races, and then they would replay the race in slow motion, there was something that just jumped out off the screen at me. And that was, you could see in slow motion, every muscle of this man's body was single-focused to winning that race. Concentrated effort. The muscles in his skull, the muscles in his hands, the muscles in his legs, everything was just concentrated on winning that race, concentrating all our energies. And perhaps that's what the picture is here for us in running for the prize of high calling. We are concentrating all of our energies in running in that race that we're permitted to run in. "And they shall walk and not faint." What are we walking for? Well, Romans chapter 8, verse 4, I think helps us. Romans 8:4, where Paul says that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. You know, it's tiring to keep swimming upstream, isn't it? The easiest thing we can do is just kind of start letting down, letting go our energies, and kind of start going with the flow. You know, I find myself picking up worldly phrases at times. And I'm sure that, have you heard the one recently that says, "I don't have a clue"? That's become very popular in our area. And frankly, it has really become kind of distasteful to me personally. Because again, it's a little thing, but it's sort of picking up a worldly phrase, picking up a little bit of the way of the world. And so I've really tried to, I was using that for a while, and I thought, you know, this just doesn't feel right. It's a little tiny thing. But it's very difficult to keep fighting against the world, the flesh, and the adversary. But we're counseled, friends, to keep trying. They shall walk and not get tired. We're talking here about maintaining spiritual vitality, spiritual vigor, spiritual strength. And we're talking about regaining and indeed increasing this spiritual vigor that's brought to our attention in this text. But all of this idea of being strengthened spiritually in the center part of our theme text is dependent upon the first part. But they that wait upon the Lord. Now, what does it mean? How do we go about waiting upon or intertwining ourselves or binding ourselves together with the Lord? How do we do that? Well, certainly there are many ways in which we could go through and list, but we believe that there's several, or just a few of them rather, that we would like to focus on. Psalms 123, verse 2. Psalms 123, verse 2. Behold, as the eyes of the servants look upon the hand of their masters, and as the eyes of a maiden unto the hand of their mistress, so our eyes wait upon the Lord our God until that He have mercy on us. Friends, we believe that the idea here is, as the eyes of the servant look into the hand of their masters, and today we can perhaps exchange the word servant for the employee, for the word employee. Likewise with the maid. It can be maybe a lady employee. Maybe this is talking about a man and a lady employee. But the employees look to the hand of their employers for guidance, for direction, for instruction in what they are to do. And so we believe that the thought here is that you and I are counseled as we wait upon, as our eyes wait upon the Lord. What we are doing is we are endeavoring to consult Him and to consult His will with what He would have us to do. Certainly that comes through study, it comes through prayer, it comes through a number of different avenues that we endeavor to determine the Lord's will. But let me ask you something. Have you ever had a deadline when you needed to make a decision on something, difficult decision, and you had some time to prayerfully consider which way you were going to go? Kept praying, still not sure, prayed more. Date for decision making comes. You got to make a decision. Still not quite sure which way the Lord would have you to go. But you make the decision. You make it based upon the best information and the best judgment after consulting the Lord's will that you can, but you're still not sure. You know, a few years back, before the Coughlins moved out to the eastern part of the state, we used to have sort of a running anecdote in our class that when we were wondering what to do and not quite sure, we'd say, well, you know, it's not like you pray and you go out to the mailbox the next morning and you open your mailbox and there's the answer. The Lord doesn't send any letters to us to give us exactly what the answer would be, does He? No, He doesn't seem to work that way. But friends, we believe that even though we may not know for sure what the Lord's will is, the fact that we have taken the time to consult Him, we've taken the time to invite Him into our lives, into our thought process, even if the result of that is we're still not quite sure which way He would have us to go, the fact of the matter is, we are strengthened because we know we're doing the right thing by asking Him, even if we never get a clear answer, even if we never get one of those letters in the mailbox. There are many other ways in which we can intertwine ourselves with the Lord. But we want to consider a text, again, that's very familiar to us in Acts, the third chapter. Acts chapter 3, verses 20 and 21. And He shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all His holy prophets since the world began. Bible student trademark text, isn't it? Trademark text of the brethren, the Bible students, and has been for a number of years. Well, friends, we believe, do we not, that we have entered chronologically the times of restitution of all things. And we know that principally by four different calculations, don't we? We have the law calculation based upon Leviticus, the 25th chapter. We have the prophetic calculation, also based upon the Jubilees. We have the parallel dispensations, the 1845-year parallels. That's a third way that we prove 1874. And we also know that we have the 1335 days of Daniel. Also brings us four different means of calculation to arrive at the same date. Was the Lord serious about this date? We think so. But friends, and we don't want to be misunderstood on this point. These are the ways that we know, scripturally, we know that we've entered the times of restitution. But these are academic ways. And we don't want to be misunderstood here as that somehow we're looking down our nose at these. But the question is, do we see any evidences about us to support the idea that we are in the times of restitution? Well, if we think back, where do we get most of our information concerning the times of restitution? Is it not Leviticus, the 25th chapter, where we study the Jubilees? And remember that when we study the Jubilees, there are two principal beneficiaries under the Jubilee system. The first beneficiary was the people. And we remember they were released. The bond servants, they'd get themselves into debt. They'd have to go work for somebody else until the year of the Jubilee. Their debt would be canceled. Their personal freedom would be returned to them. They would be restored to their families. And their possessions would be restored to them. So we have this first category of beneficiary under Leviticus, the 25th chapter, were the people themselves. Is that the only beneficiary that we have? No. Remember, there's a second beneficiary, the land. The land was the beneficiary of the Jubilee. What happened during the year of Jubilee with regard to the land? Nothing. No planting, no harvesting. The land was permitted to lie fallow. If we look at our earth over the past number of years, what do we see? We see pollution, water pollution, ocean dumping grounds. And we've seen the pictures of these cranes dragging up the biomedical waste from the ocean dumping grounds, rivers and streams, land pollution, toxic waste dumps. We've seen those kinds of things. Air pollution. You know, I live not too far from Pittsburgh, the city of Pittsburgh. At one time, very dirty city, extremely. Sister Catherine Rico in our class, I'm glad to have firsthand testimony. She was a medical worker. I believe she was a physical therapist at one of the hospitals down in Pittsburgh. And she said, you know, when I took the train or the bus down to Pittsburgh, I had to take two changes of clothes with me because by the time I got there, by the time I got to work, I was filthy with soot, and dirt and so on from just the ride. Well, friends, do we have any evidence? Do we have any corroborating evidence that we are in the times of restitution with regard to the land? And friends, we're going to suggest that we do have the small beginnings of the restitution of the earth. Small beginnings of the lifting of the strain upon the earth. And what do we call these? Well, today perhaps you've heard them, and I suspect that many, if not all of us in this room, have been impacted by environmental considerations. Anybody doing any recycling these days at their house? How about buying unleaded gas? Things like that. We're all in some way or other affected. But we want to take a look at something a little bit more detailed. Just out of curiosity, we did some research and we found that the state of Pennsylvania, by the way, the one of the reasons we're picking on the state of Pennsylvania here is two reasons. Number one, it's where Brother Russell was born, it's where he did most of his ministry, it's where he did his writing. It just happens to be right where I'm from, and I know a little bit more about Pennsylvania than some other states. Okay, Pennsylvania now has 180 environmental statutes on the books. They fall into two categories. Number one, preventive, the preventive category. We know what preventive means, keeps things from getting worse, or prevents new damage from occurring. Clean streams law passed. I'm just going to give you a smattering of these. Clean streams. Sweeping protection of our water sources in Pennsylvania. Air Pollution Control Act, with a state authorized a system to be set up to deal with air pollution. Pennsylvania Pesticide Control Act, dealing with the use and disposal of pesticides, things that the farmers use and so on. And one of the ones I thought was interesting was the Phosphates Ban Act. Remember, there used to be phosphates in the detergents, in our laundry detergent? Well, this was having a major, phosphate, I guess, is some kind of an acid, and it was having a major adverse impact upon the aquatic life in the Chesapeake Bay. So Pennsylvania adopted or passed this Phosphates Ban Act. These are in the category of protective. But what about, there's a second category, and that is remedial. In other words, it's not just preventing new damage. Friends, there is a number of statutes on the books in Pennsylvania right now that's actually reversing the damage that was done some years ago. Project 500. Project 500 deals with buying, you know, one of the things that's been a problem is mine lands in Pennsylvania. Buying up, this program is a program that buys up old mine lands and turns them into parks. Of course, old mining properties were pretty much of an eyesore. The federal government passed a statute, which we call Federal SMACRA, and it has within it a concept called the Abandoned Mine Lands Program. And in that program, it requires every coal company to put into this fund either 35 cents per ton for every ton of coal that it mines, if it's mined with a strip mining method, or 15 cents a ton if it's in the deep mining, mined by the deep mining method. This money goes into a fund, and then this is used to take these old abandoned mine properties that were wrecked years ago, years and years ago, back in the 1800s, and they're actually putting these, they're actually reclaiming these properties. Called a friend of mine who works for the second largest coal company in the United States. And I said, I wanted this on good authority. I said, does this really work? He said, yeah, it's working. Not perfectly. And no one's suggesting that this program is working perfectly. But they're beginning to reverse the adverse effects and the abuse that has been done to the earth, the soil that we stand on. Federal Superfund Law. The Federal Superfund Law was a federal program. We're mixing some state and federal things here, where this dealt with the most toxic waste dumps across the country. To date, and there's a lot of controversy about how well the program has worked, but to date, there have been 84 super toxic waste dumps that have been reclaimed, and the toxin has been reversed. These lands have been reclaimed. Friends, we're not suggesting that all these programs work perfectly, because they don't. We're not suggesting that there's no cheating going on in these. And we're not suggesting that there's not some new problems that are developing as a result of the different things that mankind has gotten himself into. We're still hearing about the ozone problem, acid rain, and so on. But friends, what we're suggesting is, at least with respect to the earth, we can see the beginnings of the reversal of all of the abuse that's been done to the earth. And even if you say, well, I'm not sure that these programs work very well, I think there's one thing we would have to admit, and that is people's thinking has begun to change about how we treat our earth. And there's been, I think, a major change in that. There's one other thing we want to do very quickly. Volume 2, page 182, paragraph 1. Volume 2, 182, paragraph 1. Says, but we must look for the beginnings, we're quoting now, we must look for the beginnings only of this stupendous work of restoring all things. The first few days in a typical Jubilee year would see comparatively little accomplished. And so we must expect in the first few years in the dawning of the Millennial Jubilee to see but little accomplished. Friends, just looking at Pennsylvania for a second, which we trust is sort of a representation of what's going on in all states, before 1874, how many environmental statutes had been passed in Pennsylvania? Zero. None. The closest thing we could find to that was the establishment of Yellowstone Park to try to protect the very sensitive geothermal activity that's out in that park. Between 1874 and 1974, Pennsylvania passed 30 environmental statutes. That's 100 years. So Pennsylvania became part of the Union, joined the Union about 1787. So in the first 100 years, there were none. In the second, basically, the second 100 years of Pennsylvania's existence, there were 30. And by the way, at the time that Brother Russell wrote Volume 2, which was in 1889, there were no environmental statutes in Pennsylvania. And by the time he had written the forewords, there were three. By 1916, Pennsylvania had three environmental statutes. But look what's happened between 1974 and 1996. Friends, this is only 22 years. 150 environmental statutes in 22 years. And we only had 30 in the first 200 years of the existence of the state. We should expect to see comparatively little accomplished in the first few years of the Jubilee. And when we look at the massive crescendo of this idea of environmental remediation and environmental protection, we believe the small beginnings of Earth's Jubilee. Friends, we believe that God is going to replenish and increase the spiritual vigor of those who indeed intertwine themselves with Him. And we'd like to suggest that may we keep working on intertwining ourselves with Him, finding Him in our experiences in our lives, finding Him in the current events of earth. Find Him in our experiences. We believe that that's one of the ways that we can indeed be intertwined and strengthened and rejuvenated spiritually.
Thank you, Brother West. I hope you all have a better understanding of that text.
Gracious, kind Father who art in heaven, we once again are privileged to lift our voices and raise our hearts in thanksgiving and honor and praise unto Thee. We thank Thee for the blessings of the past hour, Father. We thank Thee for permitting us to view another portion of Thy mind. Help us to walk worthy, Father, of the truths that Thou hast entrusted us with. For anything thought or said or done which was displeasing or out of harmony, we ask that it be brought to our attention and overruled. Now, Father, as we await further before Thee, ask a blessing upon the fellowship hour to follow. We ask and pray these favors and blessings through Christ. Amen.